From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. So won't you hurry? Come on, boy, see about me. See about me. See about you, baby. See about me. I even That's the Supremes, one of Motown Records' star groups. On today's Fresh Air, we conclude our soul music series with the Motown sound. We hear from the founder of Motown Records, Berry Gordy, and three of the performers who recorded for the label, Gladys Knight, Otis Williams of the Temptations, and Martha Reeves of Martha and the Vandellas. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles Smokey Robinson and his early work at Motown. The Motown sound, coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stasio. The United States and Israel say they're withdrawing their delegations from the United Nations Conference on Racism in Durban, South Africa. The announcement in Israel came after Secretary of State Colin Powell explained why the American delegation had also decided to leave. From Jerusalem, NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
Speaking in Jerusalem, Israeli Foreign Minister Shimon Peres said Israel regrets that an important convention that was supposed to defend human rights has become a source of hatred. He also called the conference an unbelievable attempt to smear Israel. Israeli officials said the U.S. and Israel jointly made the decision to withdraw after efforts to reach a compromise declaration at the World Conference Against Racism failed. Norway and Canada had attempted to mediate a compromise between the Arab states and Israel. But both the U.S. and Israel said the Arab states were trying to force the conference to adopt what they called an anti-Semitic declaration that accuses Israel of racism and apartheid. Both the U.S. and Israel had sent only mid-level delegations, anticipating they might decide to pull out. Linda Gradstein, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Palestinians say two Palestinians were killed and at least 20 were wounded by Israeli gunfire in the West Bank city of Hebron today. The Israeli army says at least six Israelis were hurt in various attacks, including two soldiers who were hurt in an explosion. Israel responded with a helicopter strike that sent missiles through the roof of a Palestinian West Bank security building. That attack was after four bombs exploded in Jerusalem earlier, injuring three people. Efforts at fighting a huge wildfire in Montana have taken a turn for the worse. The more than 1,000 firefighters that had been battling the blaze have been pulled off the lines because of strong winds near Glacier National Park. The air attack has been grounded as well. NPR's Tom Goldman has more.
The so-called Moose Fire has burned 48,000 acres of land on the western edge of Glacier National Park. One dirt road in the park has been closed, and over the weekend, firefighters helped homeowners in the area by clearing debris that could fuel the flames. A lodge on the park's Lake McDonald is about 7 or 8 miles from the fire. A Forest Service spokesman says there's an evacuation plan for the lodge, which is not in imminent danger. The main road through Glacier Park is open, as are the park's major hotels and lodges. Officials are concerned about today's weather. The forecast is low humidity and high winds, nearing 25 miles per hour. The Forest Service spokesman says it could be a rough fire day. Tom Goldman, NPR News.
U.S. financial markets are closed today because of the Labor Day holiday. In Britain, the FTSE 100 share index fell about 0.5%, closing at 53.12. In Tokyo, stocks slid nearly 3% to a 17-year low after electronics maker Hitachi Unlimited stunned the market with a big loss warning last week. You're listening to NPR News. As Vietnam commemorated its National Day yesterday, continued flooding there led to additional deaths and thousands more being driven from their homes. Michael Mathis reports from Hanoi.
Record flooding in the Mekong Delta in southern Vietnam continued to wreak havoc today, leaving 38 people dead and more than 33,000 households in need of emergency evacuation. Several weeks of heavy rains in Vietnam and upriver in neighboring Cambodia have flooded the mighty Mekong. Nine children, age 1 through 5, drowned yesterday in Vietnam's An Giang province, authorities there said. 11 people also died last month in the Central Highlands. Army units and youth brigades have led a major rescue and evacuation effort over the past week. Teams are doling out food and other supplies to isolated communities. This is the third straight year Vietnam has been ravaged by killer floods. Last year's Mekong floods were the worst in 40 years, killing nearly 500 people. In 1999, 600 died on the central coast. For NPR News, I'm Michael Mathis in Hanoi.
Macedonian legislators resumed debate today on reforms crucial to peace with ethnic Albanians. Debate had been suspended for 2 days by the Speaker of the Parliament. Stojan Andov alleged that Albanian guerrillas were intimidating civilians. He demanded guarantees that displaced Macedonians would be returned home soon. Meanwhile, a NATO spokesman acknowledged today there would be a serious vacuum in security in Macedonia after the alliance ends its 30-day mission. NATO troops are gathering weapons used by rebel forces. Clashes between police and angry mobs have resumed in a neighborhood of Belfast, Northern Ireland. Earlier, police held back crowds of Protestants as Roman Catholic schoolgirls were escorted to school by their parents. I'm Frank Stacio, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Duke Energy, an international energy company generating energy solutions to help meet the demands of a growing world. Duke Energy, we generate what's next.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we conclude our soul music series with Motown, the Detroit record label whose roster included Smokey Robinson, Marvin Gaye, Gladys Knight and the Pips, The Temptations, Stevie Wonder, The Supremes, The Four Tops, and Junior Walker. Here's just a few Motown hits. Motown Records had over 120 top 20 hits in the 60s. We're going to hear from the founder of the label, Berry Gordy. He created a stable of songwriters, producers, and performers that made records which appealed to black and white listeners. Gordy's formula for success combined competition and cooperation. Friday mornings, he ran meetings in which the label songwriters and producers played their latest tracks and then voted on which would be released. Some records never made it. Some were sent back to be reworked. In 1994, Berry Gordy told me the story of what happened during the Friday meeting that Norman Whitfield played his production of The Temptations' Ain't Too Proud to Beg.
My comment was I didn't really believe David Ruffin was really begging. He didn't sound like he was begging. He didn't sound like a man in pain. So after a couple of weeks, Norman came back one the next week, and it was better, but we turned it down again for some of the same kind of reasons. The following week, Norman came in there and David Ruffin's voice jumped off that record. You know, I know what you want. I mean, I came on horse, but you know what I mean. The record, he jumped off there. I mean, he was like singing for dear life. I mean, you would know that was a smash. And Norman had the fire. Norman brought the fire out.
I know you want to leave me, but I refuse to let you go. If I have to beg, plead for your sympathy, I don't mind, 'cause you mean that much to me.
As a part of the system you created at Motown was, if a record wasn't good, that kind of forced the person to either give up on the record or to do it better. So there was this always pressure to do it again, do it better. Well, here's another story with that. Tell the I Heard It Through the Grapevine story, how that got changed at a Friday morning meeting.
Well, it didn't get changed. It's just that we rejected the first one on Marvin Gaye. And that was also done by Norman Whitfield.
Norman Whitfield had produced Marvin Gaye singing I Heard It Through the Grapevine.
He had produced it on Marvin Gaye. And but at that time, Marvin Gaye was singing love-type songs. I told the producers, I thought that Marvin had this great sexual image, and he was so great and had this wonderful, smooth voice. And I wanted them to think about doing you-type songs, you know, you singing directly to women, you know, because I just felt that would be good, so they did that. Marvin was very successful with that. You are my pride and joy. You are a wonderful one, you know. And he even had one words, you, in the mirror. I look in the mirror and I see you. So it was really working really well. And then, finally, Norman came up with this song, Grapevine. I Heard It Through the Grapevine. It was about gossip and, you know, Love Me No More. It was still a love-type song, but I wanted Marvin to stay where he was. So we had a thing that Holland Dozier Holland had written called Your Unchanging Love, but it was you, your unchanging, talking directly to the women. And we released that instead of Grapevine. And so Norman was very upset. So later he then produced Grapevine on Gladys Knight. And it went to number one. And of course, I was... And Your Unchanging Love didn't do that well. And Norman never let me forget it. So a year later, he kept pushing me and pushing me and pushing me to release it again. I said, wait a minute, it's already been out. It's been number one. And you can't, you know, I mean, it's been a year. It's just number one. And so Norman said, well, I was right before and you were wrong before. So I want the record released and blah, blah, blah. And it's all in the book. And he followed me around. So we ended up releasing the record in an album.
The Marvin Gaye version of Grapevine.
The Marvin Gaye version. In one of Marvin's albums, mm-hmm. We released Grapevine, and the disc jockeys loved it so much, they played it, and we had to pull it off the album, and it went also to number one and sold even more than the original Grapevine did.
I guess this taught you to not always trust your taste, but to trust the process that you had set in motion.
That's right. The process was the thing. We're all humans, and we all have our thoughts and ideas. But as long as it was a free society, and people could win by logically winning. They had to have a point. They had to be right. 2 and 2 is 4, I'd always say, you know. And long as they knew they could do that, that's what made Motown so different. They weren't locked in. They didn't come to a place where they were, like, limited. They could go, they could dream anything, and it could be possible.
My guest is Berry Gordy, if you're just joining us, the founder of Motown Records. It's interesting to me that sometimes after a record came out, you decided, no, I don't like it, I'm going to do it again. So when Smokey Robinson's Shop Around came out, you described you were listening to it on the radio and you thought, the beat's too slow, we got to get back into the studio and redo it. Well, now how can you do that once the record's already been out? Disc jockeys have it. Disc jockeys are playing it on the air. Isn't it too late?
They said it was in the company, but I said no. I was petrified at the fact that this record was too slow. It sounded too slow. It had sounded great before, but somehow when I'm listening to it, I'm saying I'm pulling the record. It's going and it's just chugging along, and I'm saying, and after 3 days, I couldn't sleep, and I just said, hey, I got to do it again. And I don't know what the problems are going to be. I don't know what it is. All I know is I got to get this record out and tell them to send back the other ones. And it was probably a crazy thought, but it wasn't crazy because no thoughts are crazy. So I called Smokey at 3 a.m. in the morning and woke him up. He got in the studio. We recorded the song. The piano player didn't show up, so I played. But I had the life. And Smokey felt it when it was picked up a little bit, and he even got a little more life. And then, of course, when the record went to number one or number two or whatever, a big, big hit, it was great. But it was a trouble. It was trouble changing it, but it hadn't been out long enough to really take hold. And a lot of people didn't know it was a different record. We just sent it out again.
Well, why don't we hear Shop Around, the faster version, I suppose.
Yes.
When I became of age, my mother called me to her side. She said, son, you're growing up now. Pretty soon you'll take a bride. And then she said, just because you become a young man now, there's still some things that you don't understand. Now, before you ask some girl for a hand now, keep your freedom for as long as you can now. My mama told me, you better shop around.
My guest is Berry Gordy, the founder of Motown Records. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1994 interview with Berry Gordy, the founder of Motown Records. Tell me the story of how you found the Supremes.
They came in to audition for me, three young girls in the early 60s, and they were called the Primettes, and I thought they had something. I heard them and their lead singer with their little whiny voice, which was Diane Ross at the time, and I really liked him.
What did you hear and see in the Supremes that made you realize they could really make it?
Well, I saw an electrifying personality in the lead singer and a very enthusiastic feelings from the other two girls, and each one seemed to have had a different personality, but all of it was they were young and they were eager and then they were cute.
You and Diana Ross became lovers. You write in your book that you were both very discreet, although you figured everybody at Motown probably knew. Martha Reeves, in her recent autobiography, said that she felt you were paying so much attention to Diana Ross that you were paying less attention to the other women artists, particularly less attention to Martha Reeves. Did you ever worry about that yourself, that your attention to Diana Ross might happen at the expense of time you could be spending with others, or at least that they would perceive it that way?
Well, no, I never thought about it because at the time that I took interest in the Supremes, it was long before I had interest in Diana Ross on a personal level. And it was because the Supremes were able to do Broadway-type songs, and they had put on a happy face, you know, by Somebody Loves You, and Rockabye Your Baby and a Dixie Melody, and things like that that impressed me so much. Without a piano, they were so great. That gave me the idea to expand our base. So I was fighting hard to get them to do that on TV because no one would let them do it on national TV, only their hits. I knew that if I could get the Supremes to break through in this area and get into the Copacabana, for instance, it would be at the benefit of the other artist, and it was. And so I think that when Martha and the other artists read my book, they will get the same kind of reaction that Diana got and Smokey got and all the rest of them that read it and really understood. Smokey already knew what I was going through because he was with me before the company, and he saw me get that check for $3.19 or whatever, and he knew what I was going through, so he always had a lot of sympathy for me. But the other artists that just came along and went into that front door and came out another door star, and they had to go through this whole cycle of success of being famous and all this stuff. And so naturally, if I'm not there and I'm with another group that I really thought had great possibilities to take us to new horizons, and that's what I did with them. It is true that I spent a tremendous time with Diana, and it did take me away from a lot of things, you know, a lot of things. But I'm certainly very happy I did, because everybody benefited by the Supremes' success. They were the first to get a number one record in Great Britain, and then everybody went over there. I mean, so they're international stars today, in part because of the way the Supremes opened doors.
Now, let me ask you to tell the story of one of the songs that you wrote. Why don't we do Do You Love Me? This is a song that you wrote. You even did the demo for it, right? The demo recording?
Yes, I did.
Now, this is a song about somebody who is asking, do you love me now that I can dance?
Yes.
Do you dance?
Yes, somewhat now.
Somewhat.
I haven't, okay. For a long time, I've been writing a book, and I haven't done a lot of anything for the last 5 years. But that was the song that I remembered when I was going to dance, is that I had trouble dancing well enough for the girls to like to dance with me. You know, the other guys were always smoother, better dancers, better looking. It was always, I was not quite good enough. But dancing was a big deal in our neighborhood, and I couldn't dance. But later on, when I was in the record business and I wanted to write a song, I thought there must be other people like me. There must be other people that feel the same as I do. So every song I wrote started out something that I felt, but that I also felt that everybody felt, because I realized we're all really the same. We want happiness. We want love. We want peace. We want, you know, it's a matter of us communicating that to each other, and then we will basically kind of love each other because we want the same things. So I felt that that would be the situation with this song, and so I, you know, just said, you know, you broke my heart because I couldn't dance. You didn't even want me around. But now I'm back to let you know I can really shake them down. Dun, 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 dun. Do you love me? And I had this growly, rough voice, and of course the contours they had, a guy named Billy Gordon, and he heard. And I made a demo after the session. I was so excited, and I sung the whole song in my gritty, low voice, and people said, oh boy, you should record that. You should record that. I said, no way, no way. And then he sang it just like my demo, but much better.
You broke my heart because I couldn't dance. You didn't even want me around. And now I'm back to let you know I can really shake them down. Do you love me now that I can dance?
Motown is the only record company I know of that had an anthem. It was written by Smokey Robinson.
Yes.
How did it go?
It was we'd all get together in the company meetings, and whenever we closed the meeting, we'd always sing the anthem song, and everybody just had such fun singing that, and it sort of went like, oh, we are a very swinging company, working hard from day to day. Nowhere will you find more unity than at Hitsville, USA. Our employees must be neat and clean and really have something on the ball. Da, da, da. Honesty is our only policy. We're one for all and... Now we're all for one and one for all. Yes, we are a very swinging company, working hard from day to day. Nowhere will you find more unity than at Hitsville. I said Hitsville, yeah. I said Hitsville, USA.
Oh, that's so funny because it sounds more like a high school. What's the alma mater, you know,
right,
than,
right. Well, that's
than
where,
like a Smokey Robinson song.
That's right. Well, that's one of his proudest songs, believe it or not. He because he was in a contest, and we had contests for everything.
Uh-huh.
I said, okay, we need a company song, and I wanted to sound like those rah-rah songs. I wanted to sound like a college anthem or whatever would make inspire esprit de corps what I'm looking for here. And they all had a contest, and Smokey came up with it.
Barry Gordy, it was a real pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Barry Gordy founded Motown Records. Our interview was recorded in 1994. We'll hear from three Motown artists in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Someone's arms, and there you were. I needed someone to understand my ups and downs, and there you were. With sweet love and devotion, deeply touching my emotions, I wanna stop.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from the National Endowment for the Arts, and from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Ooh, gotta get away from you fast as I can.
Coming up, more about the Motown sound. We hear from Gladys Knight, Martha Reeves, and Otis Williams of The Temptations. And rock historian Ed Ward talks about Smokey Robinson's early work at Motown.
Saying the road's got to end somewhere. Oh, every road has got to end somewhere. Now is the time for the showdown. So let me give you the lowdown. We've come to the end of our road. Somewhere, say that every road has got to end somewhere. Sick
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we're concluding our week-long series on soul music with the Motown sound. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward has a profile of the early days of Motown and one of its greatest singer-songwriters, Smokey Robinson.
Everybody knows about Smokey Robinson and the Miracles' great string of hits. I counted 32 that made the black charts between 1960 and 1971. Those songs helped to define Motown in the 60s, but you might not know that before those hits came a string of records in the classic 50s vocal group tradition. When they started out, the Miracles were called the Matadors. Like many Detroit vocal groups, they had a female equivalent, the Matadorettes, which included Smokey's girlfriend, Claudette. Her brother sang with the Matadors, but he joined the Army straight out of high school, which was a shame because the group was asked to audition for Jackie Wilson's management a few days after he left. Knowing that they needed five voices to sing the material on hand, Smokey convinced Claudette to join, and then the group threw a bunch of names into a hat, names like the Five Sounds and the Gardenias. Fortunately for us, the name that came out was the Miracles. Smokey Robinson and the Gardenias? The Miracles failed the audition, but met Berry Gordy Jr. there, a young man with plans for a black-owned and operated record company based in Detroit. While he was working on it, he was writing songs for Jackie Wilson and looking for talent, and to him, the Miracles sure looked like talent. He sat down with Smokey, and they wrote a takeoff on a popular song of the day and called it Got a Job.
Walked all day till my feet were tired. I was low, I just couldn't get out. Saw a sign in a grocery store. Help is light, and we need some more.
I got a job.
To hedge their bets, they put a standard doo-wop called I Cry on the other side. Gordy got the group a contract with End Records in New York, and they followed up Got a Job, which flopped, with a song that had some elements in it Smokey would reuse later, Mama Done Told Me. Then came a song called I Need Some Money, because Gordy did, and then came the record that became the first on Gordy's new label, Motown. It was a fairly radical song, far from the old group sound, and more in line with what Gordy wanted.
She's not a bad girl because she made me
Bad Girl almost sunk the fledgling Motown label, though, and Gordy wound up having to lease the rights to the song to Chess Records in Chicago. It was enough of a hit that Gordy finally had the wherewithal to get Motown off the ground in 1959, along with a label called Tamla, for the Miracles' next record, Way Over There. Gordy just couldn't make things work. Way Over There died despite an aggressive ad campaign, and Smokey, one of the first five Motown employees, was busy helping to get the new enterprise going. That wasn't going to happen until the last months of 1960, when a Mary Wells record, Bye Bye Baby, and a Miracles record, Shop Around, put Motown on the map not only of Michigan, but of the world.
When I became of age, my mother called me to her side. She said, "Son, you're growing up now. Pretty soon you'll take a bride." And then she said, "Just because you become a young man now, there's still some things that you don't understand now. Before you ask some..."
It would take a miracle to start something like Motown again. Fortunately, in 1958, Berry Gordy had five of them, and one was named Smokey.
You better shop around. Oh, yeah, you better shop around.
Our rock historian Ed Ward lives in Berlin. Coming up, we meet three of Motown's stars. This is Fresh Air. We're concluding our soul music series with the Motown sound. The Motown group The Temptations was the most successful male vocal group of the 60s and early 70s. Their hits included My Girl, Since I Lost My Baby, The Way You Do the Things You Do, You're My Everything, and Ain't Too Proud to Beg. They were famous for their cool dance moves, as well as their lead vocals and polished harmonies. Otis Williams is the only surviving member of the original Temptations. I spoke with him in 1988, after the publication of his autobiography, Temptations.
The first song that you had that really made it onto the charts, that crossed over onto the charts, was The Way You Do the Things You Do. Now, this song was the result of a competition in-house, right?
Well, Berry always, he always had that competitiveness with his writers and his producers. You know, whoever would come up with the best product would get the release, and if they did it often enough, would get the most release, which would mean that you would make a lot of money. So Smokey had been writing, you know, and being very successful.
This is Smokey Robinson, who was your producer for a long time.
Right, and he had produced quite a few hits on Mary Wells. And when she left, that kind of opened up a little vacuum. So I guess he said, well, after writing My Guy, let me write My Girl. And so in 64, we recorded My Girl at the end of 64. And it was a big hit, came February of 65.
Now, The Way You Do the Things You Do, Smokey Robinson also wrote that.
Yes, Smokey Robinson and Bobby Rogers.
The lead singer on this is Eddie Kendricks.
Eddie Kendricks.
And let's give it a listen, then we'll talk about the vocal harmonies. Okay.
You got a smile so bright, you know you could have been a candle. I'm holding you so tight, you know you could have been a handle. The way you swept me off the beat, you know you could have been a broom. The way you smell so sweet, you know you could have been some perfume. The way you do the things you do,
the way you do
all day.
Williams, which part were you singing on that record?
I was singing baritone. We would always sit around with Smokey, and Smokey was a very good producer in the respect of he would already have in mind how he wanted the harmonies to be structured, who would sing, what lead, and what have you. So it really was never no problem working with Smokey, because he would say, okay, we knew Melvin would sing bass. Eddie was on lead. Paul, he sang second tenor. David did first, and I was baritone.
You describe how some of the producers would have the singers sing slightly above their range.
Yes, yes. Motown was noted for recording their songs like a step higher, because they wanted the tension, the vocal dynamics, the stressing point, the pleading sound. So when you would hear it, you could say, oh, wow, I feel what he's saying, like pain in the voice. They didn't want you to sing too relaxed, because the song wouldn't come across with that emotional outlet, that meaning where you could really feel it. So they would always cut the tunes, especially Norman and Holland and Doja Holland, would cut it a step higher, because that's the way Ain't Too Proud to Beg was recorded. It was recorded just a key too high for David, but he was able to do it, but it was not without us having to stop the tape and let him rest, because he was straining his vocal cords and his glasses were sliding all off his face and sweat was popping off. But we were, you know, just saying, go ahead, David, you can do it, you can do it. And it turned out to be one of our biggest sellers.
We got to talk about your choreography.
Okay.
The choreography for your group was done by Charlie Atkins, who was a great dancer and got his start like years before he started working with vocal groups, dancing with Honey Coles. And
absolutely.
So describe some of the steps that he choreographed for the Temptations and the names for the steps, too.
Well, actually, Charlie, like you said, from the Charlie Atkins, Cole and Atkins vaudeville days, we had checked him out a long time ago when he used to do Frankie Lyman, and he really did a wonderful job on the Cadillacs, because he brought the house down with the Cadillacs at the Fox Theater. And Charlie steps, let me tell you something, not easy.
Uh-huh.
Oh, I mean, he's got a lot of little hitch steps and a lot of little subtle movements, and you really have to pay a lot of attention, you know, because you look at the stuff that we do on stage and say, oh, that's easy. Oh, no, no, no. I mean, he's cussed us out and called us all kind of names, you know, because it would be hard to get, you know. But once you got a Charlie Atkins choreography down, you would definitely be separate and apart from any of the other acts, because his stuff is so unique that, you know, you just knew you had captured something very special, because he's not an easy fella to deal with far as his choreography.
You said there were no extra beats for corrections when he was choreographing one of your songs. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, you know, you had to learn it right then and there, because let's say if you got out of step, you would catch hell getting back in, because it's a lot of little hit steps, and he's got everything scientifically in place. So if you missed that and had to come back in, you said, oh, my God, am I going to catch back in? Because, you know, a lot of times choreography is to a certain kind of beat. Charlie would hear something that you would have to really strain to hear on the record, and he would probably pick up something like if it was a guitar lick. Well, most cases, steps are choreographed to the drum or bass lick. But he would get something that's all together, that's faint, that you would say, man, I don't even hear that. But it would be there. So if you didn't really grab hold of that and lost that step, it would take a minute to get back in. So it was very tedious in learning Charlie's routines. But like I said again, once you learn it, stand up and applaud, because it was something really unique.
Otis Williams is my guest, the founder of the Temptations. Now, Berry Gordy really wanted the group to cross over. He was into crossing
yes,
over.
Yes,
so were there things that he thought you should do to make sure you crossed over to the pop charts?
Well, he always stressed the thing of, like I said, lyrics, you know, had a large play in it, and song structure. But he also stressed that the melody would be very simple, you know, whereas, you know, even a child could hum it. So he would stress as simple as you could keep it, the more mass appeal it would have.
Well, there's certain things you're supposed to do, like for the white listeners.
Keep it simple.
Keep it simple for the white people.
Uh-huh. And for the black, but especially for, you know, that mass appeal. You know, just keep it like we said in the recording. I said it earlier today, and Joey and Suzanne, they died laughing. But when we are in the studio, sometimes you can get so sophisticated and kind of with putting certain things together. So when we get to that point, we said, no, just K-I-S-S. And that means, in our term, keep it simple, stupid. Because most cases, when you look at the top 10, records basically are very simplistic, you know, and they have that mass appeal.
Well, I got the impression that the idea was that record buyers should be able to sing along with the song, so you
That's
didn't
it.
Want to do anything too complicated that we wouldn't be able to keep up with.
That was Barry's philosophy. That's it. You hit it dead on the head.
Otis Williams is the only surviving original member of the Temptations. He's currently on tour with a revamped version of the group. Our interview was recorded in 1988.
Ooh, your love is fading. I can feel your love fading. Girl, it's fading away from me. Cause your touch has grown cold. As if someone else controls your very soul.
Temptations, recorded in 1966. That's the year Gladys Knight and the Pips joined Motown Records. They stayed for 8 years. Their Motown hits included The End of Our Road, I Heard It Through the Grapevine, If I Were Your Woman, and Neither One of Us. Both Marvin Gaye and Gladys Knight and the Pips had hit recordings of I Heard It Through the Grapevine. In 1996, during an onstage interview in San Francisco, I asked Gladys Knight to tell the story of her recording of the song.
I know that the song had been sitting on the shelf and demoed a couple of times, just trying to see what could be done with it. Matter of fact, Barrett, who was one of the writers on the song, Barrett Strong, did it himself. And it was just kind of sitting around. So when the producer came to us with this particular song, it was like, hey, I really believe in this song, Norman Whitfield and Barrett Strong. And just take it and play with it. And we took the song with us on the road, and we were in the hotels. We sit out in the hall and work on our little song and stuff like that. And
can you tell us a little bit how you worked on that song, what the song sounded like before you started working on it, what you put into it that wasn't written in?
Well, we created the whole background for I Heard It Through the Grapevine. We created the whole background.
All the Oh Yes I Do
things
too?
Yeah. You go, Terry. Yep. We did the you know, oh yes I am, oh yes I am. Don't you know that I heard it? We did all of the black background things that you heard. We did those, and what happened was we kind of broke it up. It wasn't quite put together. Verse, chorus, like we ended up with it. And so we just tore it apart, put it back together. We would get up in the morning, fix our breakfast while we're planning. We would tape what we had in mind, and eventually we felt we had it right. We ran down to the studio, and we played it for Norman, and he was so excited. He just flipped. I mean, he just, hey. And Smokey happened to be in the studio. Smokey Robinson happened to be in the studio that afternoon. In Studio A, and we needed a studio because he wanted us to record it right then. And so we went upstairs, and he asked Smokey if we could borrow the studio, and Smokey said, yeah, you know. So we went on in the studio, and we recorded it right then, and it became the biggest selling record Motown had that year, and it became our first number one record. And then along came Marvin that next year. This was in 1967 for us. 1968, Marvin came out with I Heard It Through the Grapevine.
Between the two.
My interview with Gladys Knight was recorded in 1996. Coming up, Martha Reeves of the Motown group Martha Reeves and the Vandellas. This is Fresh Air. We're going to close our program on the Motown sound with Martha Reeves, the lead singer of Martha and the Vandellas. Come and Get These Memories was Martha and the Vandellas' first Motown hit. Their other hits included Dancing in the Street, Heat Wave, Jimmy Mack, and Quicksand. I spoke with Martha Reeves in 1994 and asked her about performing in the Motown Road Tours.
You toured during the summer where there was a lot of riots in the North. And in fact, you were performing in Detroit when you had to announce on mic that the city was burning down and people should go home. Do you remember what you were singing, what you said, and how you chose your words?
I was so excited at the Fox Theater to sing Jimmy Mack, because that was our next release, our newest song. Just before I was about to sing it, I was summoned from the wings to, come here. And I went over to see what it was and was told, you've got to tell a theater full of enthusiastic fans that the city was under arrest. There was a curfew and everybody had to get home, and half of it was burning. I don't know what I said, but I did deliver it without having a panic arise. There was no one running from that theater. Everybody literally walked out calmly, and we all got home eventually to our loved ones and homes as the city burned. There were frightening times, and I was thankful when Dancing in the Street came out, because it sort of helped get everybody back together in that right frame of mind to party together and forget about all the unrest. It settled things, and everybody finally got it out of their system. The riots did a lot of good, with all the damage. I hope you can understand what I'm saying. It let a lot of people's anger out, and after everything calmed down, we saw that all we did was hurt each other and tear up some property, and we've got to live down here together no matter what it takes, so we might as well get on with life and just dance in the street and party, because, hey, baby, we're stuck with one another. Here we are.
Dancing in the Streets is a song about dancing and partying in the streets. Some people really saw it as a song that was associated with the riots, that was almost like a call to riot.
It was after the riots.
The song?
Yes.
Yeah. So what do you make
of
people who saw that association?
That's one of the reasons why I wrote my book. I have to set the record straight. Mm-hmm. I've been accused of being some kind of leader. I wish my followers would get with me, because I'm out here on my own.
I'd like you to tell us how you first recorded Dancing in the Streets.
My song... Dancing in the Street was not mine in the beginning. Marvin Gaye wrote it, along with William Stevenson and Ivy Hunter. Marvin had sang it similar, like a sort of like, calling out around the world, are you ready for a brand new beat, baby? That's sort of his style, right? Well, it didn't fit me. It wasn't in the right key for me. And I said, well, I don't really like the idea of dancing in the street. But then when I thought about it, I had been to Rio de Janeiro. I had been to New Orleans. I saw people dancing freely in the street and having a real good time. So I said, yeah, I can sing it, but let me sing it my way. The first take, they were amazed. The second take was the one we kept.
Mm-hmm.
interview with Martha Reeves was recorded in 1994. And that concludes our Soul Music series. Fresh Air's executive producer is Gani Miller. Today's edition of Soul Music Week was produced by Roberta Shurrock. Our Motown medley was produced by Audrey Bentham and Bob Purdick, who was also our engineer today. I'm Carrie Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Saab, maker of the 9.5 sedan and the 9.5 wagon. Independent quality and safety evaluations of Saab 9.5's performance available at saabusa.com. And from Delacorte Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Total Recall, a V.I. Warshawski novel by Sarah Paretsky, author of Hard Time. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Garrison Keillor talks about his new semi-autobiographical novel, Lake Wobegon Summer 1956, about a 14-year-old boy who has discovered pornography and his own urge to write. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.